Mr. Smith.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Oops. Good morning. May it please the court. I think this case affords the court an opportunity to rule for the first time on what I think is an interesting and important sentencing issue, and that's the third issue in my brief, or in my reply brief, the harmless error issue. As in many cases, Judge Gutierrez attempted to insulate his decision from meaningful appellate review by saying that even if he was wrong about the guidelines issues that we had raised in the district court, he would make the same decision and give the same sentence anyhow.
You don't think that was the truth?
I don't know whether he would give the same sentence.
Well, you said he's trying to insulate it from appellate review.
Excuse me, Judge?
You said he's trying to insulate it
from
appellate review. So he's not, when he says, I would have given you the same sentence anyway, you say he's not telling the truth.
No, I'm not saying that he's not telling the truth. I'm saying that he shouldn't be able to just say, well, I don't care what the guidelines are, or maybe, and even if I'm wrong by 111 months, which is the difference between the bottom end of the guidelines that we think are correct and what the court found, that it makes no difference to me as a judge, and I'm not giving you any reasons why it makes no difference to me, but I'm just saying that I would impose the same sentence regardless, so that I don't have to go through the trouble of resentencing your client and having him brought up to court again. The Tenth Circuit in Peña Hermosillo resoundingly rejected that type of reasoning and said they wouldn't even consider holding that the guidelines errors are harmless where there's a substantial difference between the correct guideline calculations and those that the district court found without a very cogent explanation for why the judge would give the same sentence.
Have you got any cases where this judge has done the same thing before?
Oh, I'm sure he has done the same thing in some other cases.
Do you have any cases that could show that this is a pattern? This is a regular.
I know from my own experience, Judge, that this is a regular practice with Judge Gutierrez. They're unpublished decisions, but this is a regular practice, and I also think it's a fairly common practice among many other judges. In my experience, it's not just Judge Gutierrez. So this is a significant issue, and think of it this way: my argument is the court should not adopt a rule that is a rule contrary to what I'm arguing for, making it easy for a sentencing judge to insulate his erroneous guideline determination from meaningful appellate review. I'm not saying that, I'm not arguing for an absolute position, that is, you're always entitled to a reversal and a remand for resentencing. Regardless of what rationale the court offers. But as the Tenth Circuit said and as the Seventh Circuit said in a case we cited, at least the judge must give a cogent explanation for his position that the accurate guideline range makes no difference to his decision. I mean, that might perhaps be acceptable if the difference between the correct guideline range and the incorrect guideline range was very small, but perhaps a six-month difference. Here it's 111 months.
I think you answered my question. Where do we draw the line? You're saying 6 months?
Well, maybe you shouldn't draw any line. Maybe you should require a cogent explanation in every case, and I would think that if there's a difference. even 6-month difference require a cogent explanation, because after all, the purpose of sentencing, at least after Booker, requires an explanation from the court of the basis for the sentence anyhow, particularly when it's a non-guideline sentence, but in every case. And this court actually has more, I've read that this court has more reversals than any other circuit for procedural error at sentencing, and top among those procedural errors is the failure of the sentencing judge to adequately explain the basis for his sentence. I would say that facts like these cry out for a cogent explanation, or at least some explanation of why the court would disregard a 111-month difference in the sentencing guidelines, and why that would make no difference to him. That's not imposing a big burden on the district court to provide an explanation in those fairly limited circumstances. I mean, most judges don't say, I would impose the same sentence regardless. Where they do, I think they owe the court, as well as the defendant, some sort of explanation as to why a large discrepancy in the sentencing guidelines would make no difference to them. The sentencing, I mean, this court and others have repeatedly stressed the importance of the sentencing guidelines. And in fact, Judge Kacharis, I know from long experience, is a judge who normally sentences within the sentencing guidelines. This is an unusual case where he didn't sentence within the guidelines.
Must have had a pretty good reason.
Excuse me?
He must have had a pretty good reason then.
His basic reason was the government itself recommended a non-guideline sentence of 188 months, and he went along with the government's recommendation of 188 months.
Are you asking the court to require a new sentencing hearing, or just simply remand it to the district court to provide a written explanation that we could then review?
I would ask for a new sentencing hearing, in the alternative, at least an explanation of why he would impose the same sentence. But I think it would be, in terms of judicial economy, it would make more sense to just have him resentence. He can resentence to the same amount of time if he provides a cogent and adequate explanation for why it makes no difference. So instead of doing a two-step process and perhaps forcing us to appeal once again, it would make more sense to remand for a new sentencing hearing. And the judge, again, if he wants to, can impose this. And he may very well do that. For all I know, he'll have a cogent explanation, but he hasn't provided one yet, and I don't see any harm in requiring him to do so. It looks like my 12 minutes is just about up, and I'm reserving 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Mr. English.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name's Greg English, and I've been appointed by this court to represent Mr. Salguero on this appeal. And if I may, I'd first like to address the argument we made is section 4B3, wherein we state that the court failed to apply the section 3553A factors. And the prosecution essentially concedes that point in its brief at page 39. It says, the government does not dispute that, as Salguero alleges, the district court did not specifically respond to his statements regarding his criminal history and immigration status. The government also concedes that the district court did not specifically respond to Salguero's arguments that a downward departure was warranted on the basis of his history of working hard to support a large family. The government then goes on to argue that the Lynn case simply does not apply. They say that this is harmless error in this case, and we respectfully submit where years of a person's life are concerned. The error is not harmless, as Mr. Smith has said, and similarly in this case, there's no indication that Judge Gutierrez actually considered any of the arguments that were made. He at least should have addressed what the defense had alleged below, as Lynn had required, and we respectfully submit that fairness and the appearance of fairness is required at sentencing. We also, so we submit that a remand would be appropriate in this case, and for the other argument that we had raised in section 4B2 about the court failing to sua sponte consider the defendant's alien status, that issue becomes moot if this court remands for resentencing, and we respectfully submit that doing so would conserve judicial resources because it is entirely possible that the defendant will raise a 2255 alleging ineffective assistance of counsel by the attorney who represented him at sentencing for not really arguing this issue and citing the cases that we cited here to indicate that an alien status is a legitimate basis for a departure. And finally, we respectfully submit that remand is appropriate because of two other arguments we had made. They're somewhat interrelated. Argument three, indicating the evidence was insufficient to support the findings of the jury that this conspiracy in this case involved over 5 kilos of powder cocaine. We concede there's adequate evidence for the lesser included offense of conspiracy to distribute over 500 grams, but for the 5 kilos, we submit the evidence is not sufficient. And then there's a question of how the guidelines are applied, the amount involved there. The prosecution states that the evidence showed there were 3 kilos distributed involving my client in the winter of 2010 and 2 kilos on April 10th, 2010. But we contend that my client was actually only involved in one of those. Moreover, there was never any evidence adduced at trial showing what the specific weight of those drugs were and with what precision the weights were determined. And the minimum mandatory in this case of 10 years was triggered by 5 kilos, and a deal of 4 kilos and 999 grams does not trigger that minimum mandatory. The prosecution also says that the probation officer's use of 15 kilos in determining the guideline range is appropriate because in addition to these 5 keys, there's also a conversation about another 10 keys, and we respectfully submit that idle talk on a phone that doesn't actually lead to any sort of a deal being consummated does not support that kind of escalation. And finally, the prosecution had conceded at sentencing, if I may a quote from the joint appendix at page 529, in its argument, the prosecution said, he, referring to Mr. Salguero, did come into this conspiracy rather late, and the amount of drugs he actually took possession and distributed in Philadelphia are comparatively minor compared to the other defendants. Despite this, Judge Gutierrez never made any particularized findings whatsoever with respect to the weight of the drugs involved, so we respectfully submit that's yet a third reason for this case being remanded for resentencing, so we can do it right this time. I see my time is up. Thank you very much for your patience.
Golder.
Good morning, and may it please the court. If I may, I'd like to begin with the harmless error argument that my friend Mr. Smith focused on, even though it's somewhat backwards and we believe that there was no error. I do believe that Mr. Smith and his client are making both a legal and a factual error in their harmless error analysis. As a legal matter, he's arguing that there needs to be more explanation for why Judge Gutierrez would have imposed the same sentence, and he cites a Tenth Circuit case for that. We believe that that runs headlong into this circuit's precedent in cases like Savion Matute and last month's decision in Schrader, Those are not cited in our brief, but the sites were Savioma, Tudor, 636 F3rd 119, and Schrader is 675 F3rd 300. And in those cases, they lay out this court's assumed error analysis. And in that mode of analysis, the court can assume that a judge would have imposed the same sentence if there were guidelines error, and would uphold a sentence if it was reasonably clear from the sentencing record that the judge would have imposed that sentence and the sentence was substantively reasonable. Indeed, in both of those cases, Savion Matute and Schrader, the judge didn't even say explicitly, as we have here in the judge's sentencing memorandum, that I would have imposed the same sentence. So long as it is clear and the sentence would have plainly effectuated the district court's sentencing intent, which is the quote from Schrader, and the sentence was substantively reasonable, it could be upheld. So this requirement in Peña-Hermosillo in the Tenth Circuit that there be some lengthy analysis of why the judge would have imposed the same sentence seems to be mooted or rendered irrelevant by this court's decisions where an error can just be assumed. Now, factually, we think that our friends are wrong because Judge Gutierrez was clear in sentencing about why he would have imposed the same sentence. Now, his memorandum opinion, which is at page 567D, says, I would have imposed the same sentence for the reasons stated in open court. And in open court, he said that one of the primary drivers behind the 188-month sentence was that he was trying to equate Jamin Oliva's sentence with his brother Rufino Oliva. And that was a major focus of the sentencing hearing. At page 580, the court asked government counsel, who would you find him similarly situated to? And the government counsel said, the brother Rufino. At page 585 of the joint appendix, the defense counsel responds to the Rufino analogy and says, no, actually, defendant Jamin is more similarly situated to brother Darwin Oliva. And then at page 587, when the AUSA got back up, the court asked, what do you think about this Darwin analogy? Is he closer to Rufino? And finally, on page 596 of the joint appendix, Judge Gutierrez says he was imposing the 188-month sentence to avoid unwarranted disparities with the sentence that defendant's brother Jamin got as compared to brother Rufino.
Mr. Golder, do you think that reaches the spirit of individualized sentencing? When you on the record say, I'm just trying to find out what someone else got to mirror that, is that individualized sentencing?
Really? I do believe it is, Your Honor. Well, in a couple respects. First of all, Judge Gutierrez had sentenced 15 defendants in this case. He understood the conspiracy. So what he was trying to do was situate the various defendants in their roles in the conspiracy. And he had a deep knowledge based on hearing several days' worth of trial testimony, reviewing numerous exhibits, hearing sentencing arguments from all 15 of these defendants. So he understood his role. And indeed, on page 596 of the joint appendix, after making the Rufino analogy, he said, Jamin used his granite shop as the hub of this conspiracy, as the stash house. He was involved in the financing of this conspiracy. He recruited drugs. So he understood where Jamin Oliva fit in this conspiracy.
But when you rely too heavily on that quantitative comparative, then don't you undermine the differences in the sentencing factors? For example, the background, his family circumstances. It's not just a matter of quantitatively even comparing the acts and then the sentence, but it's also that's what individualized sentencing is. They didn't come from the same households, the same neighborhoods, the same parents. The things that we believe, as Congress has, that are individualized sentencing factors.
I think that's absolutely true, Your Honor, as a theoretical matter. Here, they did happen to come from the same households, the same family circumstances, because they were brothers, and they did work together, they lived in the same town. So as a theoretical matter, it is possible for a simple mechanical placing within...
Let me explain something to you. When he wants to say something, you stop.
I apologize.
You understand that? Don't try to talk over a judge.
Sure.
But you do say there's individualized things because you know that there are siblings who have quite different paths in life who came from the same household.
That is certainly true, Your Honor.
You'll say these two didn't.
I don't know enough about their backgrounds, candidly. That wasn't put forth to the district court, that these differences weren't presented. But in terms of role in the offense, unwarranted sentencing disparities, those kind of things are factors that Congress has said to consider. So as a theoretical matter, yes, too much emphasis on a placing within a conspiracy might cause problems, but we do not believe that the record would indicate that's the case here. Turning back to whether there was error in the first place.
Following up with Judge Gregory's question, it seems odd that a district judge could use as the basis for enhancing a sentence certain enhancements that, if it turns out they were incorrect, no longer exist, and yet insist that the sentence would remain the same regardless. That seems a little bit less than fair.
I understand that point. I do think that that's sort of the point behind this court's decisions in cases like Savio Matute and Schrader, where even if you assume there was an error in the guidelines, that the court, if it had other reasons for nonetheless imposing the sentence that were plainly clear.
Kind of a heads I win, tails you lose. It doesn't matter what happens, how many issues the defense manages to prevail on, the judge always has something in his back pocket to get to where he wants to go. And at some point that becomes, there has to be some impact and perhaps some finding of error if it gets too far down the road, don't you think?
I think that, again, that may be the case. I don't think this is the case where that exists because, again, the issues related to disparities and Hamid Oliva's role in the conspiracy were pretty important factors in the judge's decision, and that's clear on 596 of the sentencing, of the joint appendix where he, in the sentencing transcript, he talks about that. I do also think, just going back to one of your questions of my friend, where do we draw the line? Even if defendant were correct here as to both of the sentencing factors, and again, we believe they're wrong, and I can address that very briefly, even if you were correct, this would still be a guideline sentence. The five-point reduction that we would get here would put the 188-month sentence at the top of the guidelines. None of the cases that defendant cites, the Tenth Circuit or the Seventh Circuit cases, involved within-guideline sentences. Those were outside the guideline sentences by significant margins. Whereas here, we would have had a within-guideline sentence, and we know from Gall that the further away you get from the guidelines, the more explanation you would need. Here, we are squarely within the guidelines at the high end, and the explanation that Judge Gutierrez gave on the record regarding disparities, regarding Hamid Oliva's role in the conspiracy, would, we believe, suffice to meet even those requirements that the Tenth Circuit or the Seventh Circuit would have imposed. But a lot of the discussion here thus far has been on assuming an error, and we do not believe that there was an error in either of the two enhancements that defendant objects to. As to the drug weight, we believe that Judge Gutierrez took a belt and suspenders approach to the drug weight in the conspiracy. He first said that defendant Hamid Oliva was responsible for the drug weight that Jorge Gutierrez, who everyone agrees was at the top of the conspiracy, and it is common ground that he was bringing in 10 to 20 kilograms a month into the United States. Judge Gutierrez said that this defendant, Hamid Oliva, was responsible for that drug weight. And we believe that the evidence in the record shows that that amount was foreseeable to Hamid Oliva. Defendant, on page 14 of his brief, only says there's no evidence in the record. He doesn't put forth any evidence explaining why it wasn't plainly or why it wasn't reasonably foreseeable, but we think that there is such evidence in the record. For example, at Joint Appendix 188, there's a phone call, a recorded phone call that's played that indicates that Hamid Oliva is talking directly with Jorge Gutierrez and says, "Do you have anything more down there?" And on page 190, he ends that conversation, "Call me with anything." On page 201, we have Rufino, the brother, again, talking with Jorge Gutierrez, the person at the top of the conspiracy, about how frequently Hamid is calling Jorge Gutierrez, complaining about the quality of the drugs. And the same thing happens in another phone call that's at page 202 of the joint appendix. All this indicates that Hamid and Jorge, the person at the top bringing in 10 to 20 kilograms every other week, were in direct contact talking about drug quantity and quality. In addition, we have Jorge Gutierrez coming to Virginia, making several trips to Virginia. There's one that's discussed in the record in September of 2009. There's testimony from Special Agent Mervis and others talking about seeing him, witnessing him in April of 2010. Here, we know from the record, page 325 of the joint appendix, that Hameen Aliba was directly sending cash, $57,000 in checks, in September of 2009, directly to Jorge Gutierrez. In January of 2010, there's another check that's sent. And then in February of 2010, Jorge Gutierrez sends a wire transfer back to Hameen. We think that the Hameen Aliba and the person at the top were in direct contact. They were closely related in this conspiracy, and therefore Judge Gutierrez was correct in concluding that all of the conspiracy's drug weight was attributable to Hameen. But even if we were wrong about that, he said the 8 to 10 kilograms that were brought up here to Virginia, to his granite shop, were attributable to Hameen Aliba. And defendant only puts forth two sentences from two DEA-6 reports that weren't part of the record to suggest that that number is wrong. He says that actually we should be relying on a 4 to 5 kilogram number that one member of the conspiracy said to a DEA agent in a DEA, and that's reflected in a DEA-6 report. But that evidence cannot establish the clear error that's required here. We believe that there are numerous other places in the record that would show that far more than 4 to 5 kilograms were brought to Virginia during the 10 trips that everyone agrees occurred. So, for example, in paragraph 88 of the pre-sentence report, Rufino, the brother, again, says that 7 kilograms was the typical amount that was brought here. And if we have the 10 trips, we know that that's 70, which would plainly support the 50 kilogram number. We also know that there were 7 kilograms found during the arrest of Javier Maldonado, who was bringing 7 kilograms to Virginia to deliver to Hameen's granite shop. We know that on page 33 of the PSR, paragraph 33 of the PSR, Javier Maldonado told the confidential source that he brought 10 kilograms in December of 2009. Joint Appendix 166 and 167, there's a call between Rufino and Jorge Gutierrez discussing an 8-kilogram shipment. So there's far more than the 4 to 5 kilograms that's being relied upon, and therefore, again, we don't believe that that can establish the firm and definite conviction that a mistake was made by Judge Gutierrez, who, again, was very familiar with this case, had heard significant evidence and sentenced numerous defendants.
Would you comment on the representation that was made that this is a common practice for Judge Gutierrez to say that he would have given the same sentence regardless of the
candidly? Candidly, Your Honor, I don't know whether it's a common practice or not. I don't think, there are a couple of times throughout this appeal in which Judge Gutierrez's reputation has been challenged, not just that kind of statement, but the statement in the briefs that he had made an error and pre-canned the sentencing memorandum. I think this is largely speculation. Judge Gutierrez is an experienced and respected judge, and I think that his memorandum here wasn't as sparse as defendant would like it to be. I think he said, for example, on the basis, I would give the same sentence for the reasons stated in open court. And again, as I presented earlier, those reasons were related to disparity in Hameen Aliba's role. So I don't think he was trying to insulate anything. I think he was saying, I've put this on the record. It's plainly clear why I think that this sentence should be imposed. And that sentence would plain, and a 188-month sentence would plainly effectuate my intent, even if I were somehow wrong about these guidelines calculations, and we would still have the 188-month top end of the guideline sentence. Now, turning to Mr. Salguero, I can again talk about the harmless error issue that defendant has raised first. And that goes to Judge Gutierrez's explanation of the individualized factors. And as we have conceded, in that situation, we do believe that there was a procedural error, but we also believe that it was harmless. And we largely rely on this court's decision in Boulware for that. That case followed Lynn and set forth essentially a two-part test for when there's a harmless error when a sentence has not been individually explained or the 3553A factors have not been individually explained. And the two parts are, first, whether the district court considered the arguments that defendant was making, and second, how strong were those arguments. And here, the record clearly indicates that Judge Gutierrez did consider those arguments in a way that is akin to what happened in Boulware. He received a 2.5-page sentencing memorandum that raised the two arguments that we're talking about here, whether defendants 20 years in the United States without a criminal record should alter his sentence and his deportability. Those are the only two that defendant raises here. Those arguments were made. He heard sentencing argument. He heard defendant allocute, and it's somewhat interesting in the sentencing transcript, and this is at JA 531, he started to give his recitation of his sentence. He stopped, allowed defendant to come up to the podium, give his allocution in which these factors were referenced, and then nonetheless imposed the sentence. He adopted the findings directly, this is at JA 527, adopted the factual findings in the pre-sentence report, which included deportability and, of course, criminal history, and nonetheless imposed a sentence. Now, as to whether these arguments were very...
You switched verbs on me. You said, first you said you were going to show the record shows that he considered. Then you proceeded to tell me everything he heard. Where's the evidence that he considered those things?
So this is what I'm using the words from Boulware, which are what were the arguments that were.
I don't understand Boulware that case, but I'm talking about in this case here. Get to where the evidence shows that he considered those.
I think it was presented to him.
That's heard and presented, but where's the evidence that he considered those?
I think. It is not evident in the record that he directly addressed them, and that is why we conceded procedural error. But the same thing happened in Boulware, where the judge didn't specifically address the factors, but this court nonetheless looked at what was presented to the district court judge, the same kinds of things: allocution, defense briefing, arguments at sentencing, and said these things were presented to the judge. Even though they weren't.
So in that case, the court made no reference to anything that was said or presented?
Yes.
But in Boulware, part of the rationale for the holding in Boulware was that the arguments for below guideline sentence were particularly weak.
Yes.
So what we have here are a couple of things that are fairly standard, I think, of all criminal defendants: the family background and the work history, absence of criminal history, things that district judges deal with all the time. But then you have this additional fact of the government acknowledging that the defendant came to the conspiracy late and recognizing that a 151-month sentence was a harsh sentence for this defendant. And we don't have anything in the record that suggests the court considered that. Isn't that the real concern?
Two responses to that, Your Honor. The first is defendant actually hasn't raised that. The two that defendant focuses on in his briefing here are the criminal history and the deportability. But I do think, even despite the fact that they haven't raised that argument, I do think that the court considered that with respect to the drug weight. He did come to the conspiracy late and therefore was not attributed a larger drug weight. It was only the 15 kilograms and not the 50 kilograms that others in the conspiracy were held to be accounted for. So I think that is how his late role in the conspiracy was addressed. And I think that is what the government attorney meant by saying he came in late, he wasn't responsible for all of the months that came before it, all of the drugs that came before it. Saguero was part of just a wing of the conspiracy in Philadelphia, an offshoot of the hub in Northern Virginia that was supplied by Jorge Gutierrez in Texas. So I think that is how the various role and responsibility was accounted for. And the judge does make a finding of the 15 kilograms on page 527 of the joint appendix, adopting those findings. And those findings in the pre-sentence report are directly related to the drug weight that's attributable. But I would...
Even that was a stretch, wasn't it, to get to 15?
I have 30 seconds and I will address that. Your Honor, I don't think that was a stretch. I think that there were plainly evidence in the record of 15, at least 15, being discussed. On Joint Appendix 73, Javier Maldonado talks about a 3-kilogram trip up to Philadelphia sometime in the winter of 2010. On Joint Appendix 75, he talks of a second 2-kilogram trip up to Philadelphia. So that would establish the five. There's the phone call on pages, Joint Appendix 132, 133, and 171 of the Joint Appendix that talk about the 10 kilogram discussion. They're plainly talking about bringing the 10 kilograms to Philadelphia. And we know from this court's decision in Brooks that negotiated but undelivered cocaine or drug weight counts towards the conspiracy. So we think that there was 15, and that's not even including what was reasonably foreseeable to the Philadelphia wing of the conspiracy, of what was going on by their suppliers, Hameen and Rufino Oliva in Virginia. So we do think that the 15 was certainly reasonable. There was no clear error there, and there was no reason to overturn that decision on a sufficiency of the evidence basis. Thank you.
Smith, you have some time remaining.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd first like to object to the fact that the government is relying on two new cases from this court, which were not cited in their briefs and not cited in a Rule 28J letter. I have no ability to respond to those briefs. To those cases, I've never heard of them. And I've had no opportunity to review them before today, so I would ask the court to either disregard those cases or give me an opportunity to file a response, because I have no idea what the facts are or the holdings of those cases. I want to address your point, Judge Traxler, about Judge Kacharis's record. My friend here has only been with the U.S. Attorney's Office for 15 months, and so it's not surprising that he's not familiar with Judge Kacharis's sentencing practices. I have the advantage here because I have been in front of Judge Kacharis since the early 1980s, both as a special assistant U.S. attorney and as a defense attorney. As a matter of fact, Judge Kacharis personally appointed me to do this appeal, as he has done in the past. And I love Judge Kacharis, but you know, everyone has their faults. And Judge Kacharis, and believe me, Judge Kacharis, if you make the effort to find out, you'll see, you can even ask Judge Kacharis, he does frequently put this boilerplate language in his memorandum decisions. And in this case, there really is no dispute that the memo was a canned memo. I mean, most judges do this. There's nothing wrong with having a memo prepared. The problem was that the judge ended up giving a sentence far below what he had planned to give, and that was because the government recommended a non-guideline sentence of 188 months at sentencing. So the judge, unfortunately, did not change the canned memo to reflect the major differences between how the sentencing hearing actually turned out and the rulings made there. For example, the judge in the canned memo rejects my discrepancy argument, but the government agreed with to the judge, and that wasn't the government didn't file a sentencing memo, so the judge was taken by surprise. And so he accepted the discrepancy argument, but the canned memo rejects it. And nonetheless, he read that from the canned memo into the record at the sentencing hearing. So he just he didn't change it. And that's another extremely important reason why the court should not accept in this case the statement that I would have given the same sentence regardless, because that sentence was nowhere in the sentencing hearing. That was in the canned memo. And how do we know, how does this court know, that the judge would actually meant that, because everything turned out differently than the judge expected when he wrote the canned memo? Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Smith.
Thank you.
I note that you and Mr. English are both court appointed. We appreciate very much your undertaking the representation of these clients.
Our pleasure.
We'll come down and greet counsel and then take a short recess.